Let's go to versus Astro, number 081576. Mr. Schultz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Laura Liskowitz. Ms. Liskowitz claims that the ALJ made several errors requiring reversal. One of those errors was the way the ALJ analyzed and weighed the opinion of the treating rheumatologist, Dr. Brezza. This is a case where the claimant's insured status, the date by which she had to prove that she was disabled, ended on December 31, 2002. Plaintiff went to see a doctor because she was having increasing joint pains, including pains in her hands. She went for also gastrointestinal problems, but the relevant portions were problems in her hands and in her joints. That was on January 17, 2003, only 17 days after the expiration of her insured status. Those doctors did a blood test or had a blood test taken, and it turned out the plaintiff had a positive rheumatoid factor. Ms. Liskowitz returned to those doctors about 2 weeks later, continuing to complain of joint pain and hand pain, at which time the doctors decided she should be sent to a rheumatologist. And apparently it took about 6 weeks for her to get in to see Dr. Brezza, the rheumatologist. Dr. Brezza examined her, diagnosed rheumatoid arthritis, which was the first time that that had been diagnosed. And Ms. Liskowitz told Dr. Brezza that she had been suffering from these increased joint pains, including the hand pains, for 6 months, which would have taken it to about 3 months prior to the expiration of her insured status. Dr. Brezza then continued to treat the claimant, and approximately or a little more than a year and a half later, after seeing her numerous times and prescribing various medications for her, the doctor filled out a report form indicating functional restrictions that he felt were in place for the claimant, including significant limitations in the use of her hands. Now, Dr. Brezza also indicated that he had reviewed all of the claimant's medical records, and he found that those limitations would have been in place going back to 1998, the alleged onset date of disability. But the key factor for Ms. Liskowitz is whether or not the doctor's opinion reasonably related back to 2002, because if it didn't, then she can never get disability insurance benefits based upon her work record. The ALJ rejected Dr. Brezza's opinion, finding that there was no basis that it could be related back to the period prior to the insured status. But the doctor saw the claimant only 2.5 months after the insured status expired. This court has held in numerous cases that retrospective opinions by treating physicians are important opinions. There does not have to be contemporaneous medical evidence prior to the expiration of the insured status, as long as there's some basis for tying in the doctor's opinion to the period prior to the expiration of the insured status.
I think the ALJ said, among other things, she didn't seek treatment for this condition during that insured period. Is that right?
It's true that she didn't seek treatment for the increase in the joint pain until January 17th. But the fact that she didn't seek treatment for 17 days after her insured status expired isn't the reasonable basis for finding that that condition didn't exist 2 weeks prior to the time she first saw the doctor. That's really, I think, the question here is that the rheumatologist who saw her, he's the only doctor who provided an opinion as to the claimant's limitations who had knowledge that the claimant suffered from rheumatoid arthritis. The doctors who saw the claimant 2 years prior to that date, she hadn't been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, wasn't complaining of hand pain in the year 2000, so they wouldn't have limited her ability to use her hands. Only Dr. Brezza provided an opinion on that question. And plaintiff believes that, therefore, the ALJ made an independent and improper medical determination in rejecting Dr. Brezza's opinion, and there's no contrary opinion for the period right before the expiration of the insured status.
Well, what corroborative evidence is there that there was something wrong with her hands during that period?
Her testimony. Her testimony is that
she was not credible.
The ALJ found that she was not credible, but that was for the entire time period. The ALJ made no credibility determination concerning the claimant's use of her hands or her testimony that this problem with her hands started several months before the insured status expired. And the other thing, this court held in the Allard versus Astru case, that if there's a natural progression of a disease, that a treating specialist may be able to provide an opinion as to when the functional limitations would have been in place. So again, Dr. Brezza, who's the only specialist who examined the plaintiff and provided an opinion, he saw the claimant only 2.5 months later, reviewed records from doctors who saw her only 2 weeks later. He was in a position to provide the opinion that those limitations existed prior to the expiration of the insured status. And the ALJ had no medical basis on this record to reject Dr. Brezza's opinion. Next issue.
Did she make any statement during that period to the effect that she was suffering from hand pain?
No, she did not. It was 2.5 weeks.
It was all after.
2.5 weeks later. That's correct, John. The next issue raised by the plaintiff is that the ALJ erred in addressing the vocational expert's testimony in this case. The preliminary and primary or initial error the ALJ made was that during the hearing, plaintiff's counsel cross-examined the vocational expert, and the vocational expert stated that she did not know whether the underlying data that she relied on to provide her opinion was itself, in fact, reliable. Post-hearing, the counsel wrote a letter to the ALJ objecting to the admission of the vocational expert's testimony because of that, the fact that she stated that she didn't know if the underlying data was reliable. In her decision, the ALJ does not address that issue at all. The ALJ finds the vocational expert's testimony credible, but doesn't address the question of the reliability of the VE's testimony. And this court has held in several recent cases, in the recent Overman case and the McKinney case and the Donahue case, that if the reliability of the vocational expert's testimony is questioned at the hearing, that the ALJ has a responsibility then to make an appropriate inquiry to, in fact, establish the reliability of that testimony. The commissioner has raised several arguments as to why the ALJ could have found the VE's testimony reliable in this case, but that's based on theories that the ALJ didn't rely on because the ALJ didn't address that issue at all in her decision.
Well, weren't the statistics acquired from government sources?
Well, they were acquired from various sources.
Well, there were some who was acquired from a non-government source, but it was a source that was commonly used in these inquiries, was it not?
Well, actually, the ALJ asked the vocational expert whether those sources were widely accepted in the area of vocational rehabilitation. ALJ didn't specifically ask the expert whether those sources were used to provide numbers of jobs that are available in Social Security cases. So the ALJ's question didn't really even go to the question at hand. But I think more fundamentally, if an ALJ calls an expert to testify on a question that where the commissioner has the burden of proof, which the commissioner does at step 5 of the sequential evaluation process, to prove that there are jobs available to the claimant. And if that expert says that I've been doing research into the reliability of the sources that I use, but I don't know whether or not they're reliable, and the counsel questions the vocational expert further, and she reiterates that opinion at least 2 other times, that she doesn't know whether the data was reliable, and that she used not one data source, but a compilation of data sources in order to provide her testimony, well, the ALJ has no basis to find that testimony reliable. The fact that other vocational experts might rely on some of the same data doesn't establish that for the purposes that the vocational expert was testifying in this case, that this data was, in fact, reliable. We raise in our brief the fact that the government actually doesn't maintain statistics which are sufficient to meet the commissioner's burden of proof at step 5 of the sequential evaluation process. In fact, United Stats Publishing, that one private entity that the vocational expert relied on, we put in a footnote in our brief and on their website, they indicate that no government entity provides job data based on Dictionary of Occupational Title. And in the census all government statistics on job numbers are based on the census, which is the long form in the census, which is, I think, sent to one out of every six individuals or households. The census doesn't ask any questions which would allow a determination of how many jobs or what jobs are skilled or what exertional level the job is at. So when a vocational expert says they relied on the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for instance, to indicate that there are receptionist or loan interview clerk jobs, those jobs might all be skilled jobs beyond the ability of the claimant in question. You can't tell how many of those unskilled or semi-skilled jobs are available to an individual claimant based on government statistics. Vocational experts have to rely on other statistics in order to come up with the numbers of jobs for the type of claimant involved. Because, again, here the ALJ gave specific limitations, sedentary work, sit-stand option, shouldn't be around respiratory irritants. The vocational expert has to have some reliable basis for determining the numbers of those jobs that Ms. Liskowitz could perform. And she said that she had no idea whether the underlying data was reliable, at which point the ALJ either should have cross-examined her in more detail to try to rehabilitate the expert's own opinion as to the reliability of the data, or the ALJ could have called a supplemental hearing, called in another vocational expert who maybe had finished their research.
Do you know a source that, without going to each job individually and getting information on it, that does give that more thorough determination of whether or not a person with those conditions can perform it?
Well, I don't think there's any reliable source, which is why
what's the VE supposed to do?
Well, there are vocational experts who do labor market surveys, who actually have contacted employers and asked them questions about claimants with certain limitations, and they come in and provide those an assessment based on those labor market surveys. Or vocational experts might just have personal experience of placing people in jobs, and they might say, I've placed X number of people as cashiers at movie theaters, and I know that there are 10 such movie theaters in this area, so there are at least 200 unskilled cashier jobs, that kind of thing.
So the VE should be someone who's in the business of, I guess, putting people to work.
Well, that's what I believe all the VEs actually are in the business of when they're not testifying.
That's what you usually explore when you start out with a witness like that? What is your background? What do you do? And that sort of thing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We don't get the record of all that. That's not much of it, at least.
No, not in this
case. Now, you also said something, you're concerned about part-time.
That's correct.
What's the problem there?
Okay. At step five of the evaluation process, a claimant is disabled unless they can perform full-time work. So when you're looking at the question of whether there are a significant number of jobs that a claimant could perform, it's not a logical step to say that if the person can perform part-time work, they're not disabled, when, unless they can perform full-time work, they must be considered disabled. The commissioner did not argue, because I believe it's their position, that part-time jobs do not play a part in any step five determination. The commissioner argues that the ALJ could have speculated that there were still a sufficient number of full-time jobs based on the vocational expert's testimony. And often a vocational expert will give an opinion that there are 50% of these jobs are full-time and 50% part-time or something like that. But in this case, the VE said only, I have no idea how many of these jobs are full-time or how many are part-time. So on this record, there's no way to determine the number of full-time.
Do we need to cure that or remand it to get more for the VE to say what percentage that is?
Yes, because on this record we have no idea. Because, again, the vocational expert was talking about a specific type of job which required, for instance, a sit-stand option. Well, maybe the only sedentary jobs that allow for a sit-stand option are part-time jobs. So they may all be part-time jobs for all we know based on this record. So I do believe the matter should be remanded for that.
All these statistics kept on a part-time... Are those two categories always kept in the same list, part-time and full-time?
I believe they are, but there are statistics for some jobs, at least that I've seen, that like the Bureau of Labor Statistics does provide some information as to what percentage of certain jobs are full time and what are part time. But that evidence isn't of record, so there's no way for the courts to have determined or for the ALJ to have determined the number of jobs that were part time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Suzanne Duman on behalf of the Commissioner this morning. I'd like to start by responding to the arguments about Dr. Brezza. Now, plaintiff has relied pretty heavily on Dr. Brezza's opinion, but I would point out that in the reply brief, they basically concede that the ALJ was reasonable in rejecting Dr. Brezza's opinion, at least to the extent that the doctor was attempting to relate these extreme limitations all the way back to 1998. So she admits in her reply brief that it was reasonable for the ALJ to say that the opinion was not supported as of that time. Now, what she's trying to urge is that the ALJ then should have said, well, maybe it wasn't supported back then, but maybe it was supported as of December 2002, which is something the doctor himself didn't even suggest. But if you look at Dr. Brezza's findings, they really don't support the opinion even as of December 2002. Now, you remember, Dr. Brezza didn't start seeing her until after her insured status expired. And at that time, he found, especially with respect to the upper extremities, there were no limitations in range of motion, and there was no synovitis. And there was only one mention, as counsel brought up, that may have related the hand pain back maybe a couple months before the insured status expired. But that piece of evidence is really pretty iffy. She was complaining of joint pain throughout her body pretty much at that point. And remember, she had a congenital hip condition since she was born. So she's always had some hip pain. She's always had some knee pain related to that condition. So it's not surprising that she had some joint pain relating back prior to her date last insured, and the ALJ accommodated that. It's really not all that clear that she had significant hand pain prior to her date last insured. And as I said, the medical evidence shows that it certainly wasn't having an impact on her after her date last insured. In fact, in June 2004, which is about a year and 6 months after her insured status expired, Dr. Brezza did some additional testing to see if the rheumatoid arthritis was more aggressive than they had thought. And at that point, the testing showed that it was a mild condition, and he took back her medications and readjusted those, saying that it was just a mild condition. So even as of that point, the rheumatoid arthritis was pretty mild.
Now, presumably, being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis doesn't automatically make you disabled.
Absolutely.
I assume there are certain jobs one can do, at least for a while.
Certainly, and really what the key question here is not when did she have rheumatoid arthritis, but when did that condition deteriorate to the extent that it would further limit her. And there's really no evidence that it was starting to limit her upper extremities for sure prior to her date last insured. Now, remember, she already had some conditions on her lower extremities prior to this rheumatoid arthritis, and the ALJ accommodated those. But the real question is, regardless of when she first had rheumatoid arthritis, when did it start limiting her further? And it was absolutely reasonable on this record for the ALJ to say there really weren't additional limitations, at least as of that date last insured, especially when you're looking at the hands and the upper extremities.
When did it affect her upper body, isn't it?
Exactly. And the evidence regarding the upper body in particular really doesn't relate back. And that was perfectly reasonable. And as counsel pointed out, the other three doctors who did offer opinions during that relevant time period, none of them were aware of the rheumatoid arthritis, and none of them were aware of the hand problems. And there's a good reason for that, because the rheumatoid arthritis had not really advanced to any extent that it was affecting her upper extremities as of that time. So the ALJ really reasonably relied on the other three physicians' opinions that were contemporaneous and were supported by the evidence at that time. The other argument that was raised today relates to the vocational expert's testimony. McKinney, as counsel pointed out, requires that once there's been a question about the underlying foundation of the vocational expert's testimony, then the ALJ is supposed to inquire about that. And that's exactly what the ALJ did here. She started asking questions. Where do you get the foundation for this question? And the VE gave two responses that pretty much took care of the question.
The problem is she didn't get very good answers, isn't it?
She really kind of did, because despite what counsel says, she said over and over again that the numbers of jobs that she relied on, and that's what we're looking at, the numbers of jobs came from three government agencies, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Department of Labor, actually I'm not sure, I'm really sure they're separate agencies, but those two, and also the Northwest Wisconsin Workforce Development, which is a state agency as well, and even counsel's cross-examination questions established, so these came from three government agencies, right? So all along, the vocational expert was very explicit that the numbers came from government entities. And when she said she wasn't sure about reliability, it was always in the context of, I'm not sure if those government statistics are reliable. I'm still researching that. So the other research sources she gave, she may have looked to those. For example, the Dictionary of Occupational Titles gives you, like, when you have kneeling, bending, stooping issues. She certainly should have looked to that for those issues. But for those numbers, she looked to those two resources, strictly relied on government statistics. And while she may not be sure about the reliability of government statistics, SSA has taken administrative notice of the reliability of those statistics. I'm not sure anyone else even collects those statistics. So this is not only probably the most reasonable we have, but maybe the only statistics we have when we get to those things.
Well, I guess that's sort of the question is what sources are there that would be better, or is there something more detailed?
The opponent
says something about it would be better for her to have more, I guess, personal knowledge of the actual requirements in certain jobs matching with her, with the described capacity, I guess.
And I think that's true. This vocational expert did have some of that experience. But I think what was missing here, because it didn't come up until the reply brief, is that the Occupational Employment Quarterly, which is one of the resources that the vocational expert did rely on, if you look at a sample of that on the internet, it actually does break down the jobs by census code, and it says for unskilled jobs, there are so many at the sedentary, light, medium, and heavy level. For semi-skilled, there are so many at the sedentary, light, medium. So there is a resource out there that does collect the government information and break it down by skilled versus semi-skilled, by exertional level as well. Now, keep in mind, counsel did not raise this argument about how the statistics were not broken down by skill and by exertional level until his reply brief in the Court of Appeals. And this is precisely the kind of question that should have been posed to a vocational expert at the hearing. If he wanted to know how she got the numbers broken down by that level, that's something a vocational expert needs to explain. I'm not a vocational expert. Opposing counsel is not a vocational expert. It was not developed in this record. It's not appropriate to be deciding at this time. What we had in the question before us at that hearing was, where did these numbers come from? She was very explicit. They came from government statistics. And even the letter to the ALJ afterwards, counsel said, we don't believe that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is reliable. That's great, but Social Security Administration has taken administrative notice of that. At the hearing, the ALJ resolved all of the concerns that were raised, that were properly raised. There was no reason for her to further address that in the decision. It was resolved at the hearing, just as McKinney requires. You did bring up the part-time work question. And this vocational expert did testify that some of the jobs, the numbers of jobs that she was able to get from the government statistics were not broken down by part-time versus full-time. Now, keep in mind, the ALJ...
Is that generally done by the government or not?
As far as I know, I'm not aware of anything. I did see on the U.S. publishing site that they estimated that, I'm not sure where they got their statistics, but they're saying certain jobs certainly have more prevalence of part-time jobs like waiters, waitresses, and retail sales were the examples they gave, and some have very low incidence like professional jobs. And they said, though, that the average is 18%. So they got that average from somewhere. But we don't know for sure what the percentage was on these jobs. Now, again, I'll point out, the ALJ did find that Ms. Liskowitz could do full-time work. That means she can do both the full-time and part-time work. She can do all the jobs that the vocational expert identified. The only thing is, as a matter of policy, SSA does look at the full-time jobs. Now, while we have that policy, there's really nothing in the rulings or regulations that requires that the ALJ or the vocational expert identify precisely how many are full-time and part-time. And in this case, we had such a large number that it was reasonable for the ALJ to say, even if, you know, a good number of these are part-time, there's still going to be a significant number of jobs. In fact, even if you divided them in half, or a little more than that, you'd still be well within the boundaries of what this court has recognized as a significant number of jobs. The VE testified that the numbers of jobs that were part-time versus full-time were not available. She gave the best information that was out there. There's no reason to believe that if we remanded this case that we should get a different answer. And even if we did, with numbers that large, the chances that it would be an insignificant number are just infinitesimal. The ALJ has a right to decide when enough is enough. We've had two hearings in this case. We had two vocational experts. Both of them identified thousands and thousands of jobs this woman could perform. The ALJ was reasonably found that was sufficient. And the Britton case, this court recognized we have to give the ALJ some kind of a way to strike a balance between giving effective cross-examination and deciding all of these cases. There was ample opportunity for cross-examination. There was ample opportunity to provide vocational evidence afterwards regarding these jobs. That was not done. On the flip side, we have 738,000 cases right now awaiting a hearing decision. And the average amount of time they have to wait is 505 days. That's the highest it's ever been. We're dealing with enormous caseloads in these cases. It was reasonable for this ALJ to say, look, I have enough here to decide there's a sufficient number of full-time jobs this woman can perform, given the testimony that two VEs gave me. And we should respect her decision on that. Do you have any other questions or concerns?
It's just the same. In part-time, I guess you could have theoretically two part-time jobs. I don't know whether that works out or not, but you have to base it on full-time, isn't that right?
Pardon?
Full-time. Full-time.
We look at full-time, yes. And I do believe that, and don't quote me on this, but I do think the numbers are total numbers, like they don't add up two part-times as a full-time. But I'm not entirely sure about that. Okay.
And things are so jammed up, the ALJs can't really do a thorough job anymore, is that?
Well, I think the ALJ did a pretty thorough job in this case because she did ask her, where'd you get these statistics? She gave the three government agencies. She gave the book. She had one of the books there in front of her open at the hearing. They were pretty thorough in this case, and it was the second hearing with the second VE. I mean, that's pretty good considering the number of cases we have to decide.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
What's that? No time. I'll give you an additional minute if you want to respond.
First, just to remind the court, it's the commissioner's burden of proof at step five, so it's not if there's some vague answers that a vocational experts give, the commissioner hasn't met his burden of proving that these jobs exist. Secondly, the attorney didn't cross-examine the vocational expert any further in this case, because he got testimony from her that repeated testimony that she didn't know the reliability of the sources that she used, and she used more than just governmental sources. She specifically says that she used other sources. I don't have time to go into it fully, but the Occupational Employment Quarterly, published by United States Publishing, is one of the documents the plaintiff's attorneys have a problem with in terms of the reliability of their statistics. So while they do break down the numbers, there's a question of how that's done and whether it meets any sufficient standards. That wasn't gone into in this case because there's no reason to question the vocational expert further as to her underlying data when she didn't know whether it was reliable or not. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case will be taken under advisement.